world is watching with their eagles.
Do it.
I want you to get excited about your life.
Here we go. In 10.
Stand by camera 6.
If it's happening now,
woo. Hi, Dr. Phil. Yes, my husband and I have been married for about 10 years, and he's turning 40 this year. And unfortunately, he still refuses to eat his vegetables. So I'm worried about his lifestyle, his eating habits. What can he do to be healthier? Thanks.
It's very mysterious because of my friend, my associate, who, by the way, who in the CIA, who actually used to work for me when I was in the military. He said that he had seen request forms for equipment and biological containment equipment to be sent somewhere into the Brewster area.
Thanks.
Coming up. Let's do it.
Hi, Dr. Phil. My wife and I have been married for 20 years, and we're trying to rekindle the spark in our relationship that we had when we were first going out. Do you have any tips on rekindling that spark?
You know, she was very sincere about what she was doing, and that's good. But there are people who are out there who are not sincere about what they're doing in UFOs. And, you know, but the fact is that, you know, there are many people who, you know, they want to believe that they're getting telepathic messages. They want to believe that they have special connection that takes them out of this world. They want to believe that they did something extraordinary rather than, you know, most people to get attention. But overall, most of these people, you know, they really want to believe too much. And I think when you want to believe too much, it gets in the way of objective research. And when I look into cases and go out to cases, I have no idea what I'm getting into.
Okay. That's that's great. Thanks. Thanks.
Coming up. Let's do it.
And so it begins, Jeff. So it begins.
What's that?
Paratopia.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Here is another Dynamic Duo episode featuring, well, the dynamic, that would be Jeff, and then the other part, which is me.
Right.
That makes a duo. Two.
Right.
We just learned something. Yeah. Math.
There you are.
Why are we here, Jeff? Why are we doing another duo episode?
Because no one wants to speak to us.
No, lie. Make something up.
We had a 3-hour conversation last night that lasted till almost 3 a.m. And it was great. It was brilliant. And we didn't record it.
You did most of the talking.
That's why it was brilliant.
Oh. Yes. Well, when last we met here on the Dynamic Duo episodes, which I think was the Evolver episode, I could be wrong, but I think it was, you had talked about feeling as though you're a little kid or something along those lines when in the presence of this phenomena.
Right.
And I completely understand what you're saying, and it just got me to thinking about what is the nature of adulthood. Which we didn't really get into last night during our 3-hour tour, our 3 a.m. conversation.
Right.
But I kind of wanted to talk about that and then just see where it goes and you know, talk about a whole host of things, as we're prone to do in these windy, twisty shows.
Yeah, sure.
Because now, but last night I did bring it up to you, and I said, you know, what does it mean to be an adult? And, of course, you said, well, I know when I was a kid, I certainly didn't have to pay for things and didn't have to go to work and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But I guess what I'm asking is slightly deeper than that, which is, what is it that we grow into What is it that we've become that, in the face of this phenomena, that's wiped away? Does that imply that that is not real, that that is not truly who we are, that we've built up some sort of construct and it gets wiped away in the face of, you know, let's call them real adults?
Right.
Is that what happens? I mean, what is that? What is it? Because I think there's a clue there, you know?
Well, I think it's and something came to me actually after we concluded last night and hung up, and I'll bring that up later. But just remind me of that if we forget about it.
Okay.
I think to be honest with you, to me, I mean, I mentioned the bills and the mortgage and the wife and the kid and all that, and you mentioned that as something that is surface level, but I think that's part of what becomes the deeper level, in which it is becoming numb to certain things. And I think that's what we grow into. I think we grow into a numbness, a sensory numbness. I think when you're a kid, Jim Morrison, brilliant poet, pretty good singer, but one of his poems talked about, a kid, when he's really young, his head is just kind of like a flower. It's just blowing in the breeze. And I think I look at a lot of little kids and I see them as not wearing a mask of sorts. We've talked about masks on this show before that people wear. And I think kids don't wear those masks for the first so many years of their lives until it becomes necessary. So we're like a product of an environment that almost doesn't allow us to survive in it without being a certain way. Would you agree with that? I mean,
yeah.
And so those masks go on, and when those masks go on, then I think that's when you start to see the wrong. I think when you're a kid, you may see bad things on TV, or you may see somebody on television in a drama doing some, doing something bad, and you may recognize that as bad, but until you actually witness something bad happening to you or to somebody you love, or you're very trusting as a child. This is why so many children disappear every year. But children are just trusting. They think everybody is friendly and they're friendly to everyone. And no doubt this is why it was written, be as little children, retain that innocence about life and about people. And unfortunately, the world doesn't do that. So to survive in this world, you must put on the armor. And when the armor goes on, then the cynicism starts. And I think there's a very clear departure when you're a kid growing into adulthood, where you leave, I guess what some people would call the childish things behind. You leave behind the importance of dreams and the daydream and all of that. I mean, all of that kind of gets left behind, and up to and including, I would say, some of these more anomalous experiences that I think children recognize and see just because they are so thrown open to the world. I mean, you are sucking in every little bit of everything. And I think as a kid, that's why these experiences start at 5 years old, 4 years old. It's just about the time where you're starting to kind of understand there are mean kids, there are people that you're not sure you like or that you trust. You're just starting to get that bearing of growing up. You're almost losing your infantile ways at that age. And that's when kindergarten starts and you start interacting with other kids. And I mean, it just goes on from there. I think that's when when you're little and you can't speak. I mean, we made a joke of this last night where babies probably see everything, and the powers that be say, okay, here we got it. Babies won't be allowed to talk about what they can see, so they can see anything they want. They can see it all, but the adults, now they can talk, so we have to rob them of something. So
here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Straight out of left field. Now, when I did the mushroom trip, and what I perceived to be the mushroom entity is going, this is awesome. Don't you want this? This is great. And I'm going, yeah, it is awesome.
All right.
That doesn't feel like the same sort of thing. But there's a similarity there, I suppose, just in the sort of like, I don't know, almost in the way that you lose your adult mask if you go to an amusement park. If you're someone who really loves amusement parks and you just lose that mask, you know, to go on a roller coaster and have fun and let your hair loose kind of thing. I mean, that was really what the mushroom trip was. It was like, let's let our hair loose and isn't this awesome? But I almost wonder, do you think that the thing that felt grating on my nerves about that would be that I didn't completely lose my sense of adult self, and so it felt...
No, but I think it definitely shoves that to the back seat. Would you not agree? I mean,
yeah, it shoves it to the back seat, but it feels like a manipulation as opposed to, you know, but maybe the manipulation is that it's something else seemingly trying to do this to me as opposed to it just naturally falling away as the product of being in contact with something that makes that happen. You know?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think it's... I think it definitely, at least for me, it felt every bit like being a kid. I mean, it felt like it literally stripped away.
Doing the shrooms?
Yeah. It felt like it stripped away the mask, the attitude, the cynicism. Certainly the anger was, you know, thoughts of the world, thoughts of normal things were backseat would be an understatement. I'd say more like bound and tied and put in the trunk. Those just were not even in the scope of thought at all. What was more in the scope of thought was feelings stripped away from. I mean, and that brings with it, I think, a certain amount of fear when you're an adult, and that armor is stripped away from you that you've built up over time. And that gets pulled away by something. I think that's pretty pretty scary to be so naked to reality, to like, you know, to that degree. But there was, I agree with you, there's still a part of you that's kind of way in the background going, oh my God. I mean, what? There's part of you that, I mean, at least the part of me that was kind of panicky, was still back there saying, this is not happening. This is not happening. This is, you know, what's going on? What?
But that is not true of the phenomena.
It's not true of that. No. I think you more forward thought, you're more forward thinking in the midst of something unknown like that. That's, I don't know, that's right in front of you or is happening at that moment. And I mentioned, you know, to you last night that, it really, I mean, what I've said on message boards for a while is that it's great to talk about this stuff, but it's different when it's standing in the floor. And I mentioned to you last night that a friend of mine, two friends of mine, that had seen a very definitive craft with me at extremely close. You know, the one guy was very silent and barely spoke to me again, and the other one was completely hysterical. And I think that hysterical nature is just seeing something like that and the absolute realization that, hey, guess what? It's really there. It's more than just talk now. And, you know, I think in subsequent conversations and talking to him, I said, you know, something about the feeling of being thrown out. There's almost this feeling of being backstage in normal life, and then this kind of thing kind of feels like it shoves you out onto a one spotlight stage in front of a bunch of people. It's that kind of feeling. It's almost on the verge of an embarrassment type feeling to me. Maybe that's what it is, that maybe that's the better description for this. It's almost like being shoved into a really crowded room where everyone's sitting and you're the only one standing. That sort of feeling, I guess. And that I think most often equates to youth and being a kid and not knowing your place and kind of taking those first steps into the larger world that you're going to be living and growing up in. Maybe that's it.
Well, it's interesting. Let's see if we can tie some of this up, because you know, one thing that we talk about now and then is for all the shit people give Strieber, he certainly made the connection between this phenomena and the dead.
Yeah,
which strikes both of us as correct. I think I may have talked about this on another episode. If so, forgive me again for talking about it again. But I have a friend who's an experiencer who had a relative who died, and then he had an experience where he saw her, but she was a little kid. And he couldn't quite remember if she was a little girl or a little boy, sort of a little androgynous child, but was very definitely her. And it was like that was her authentic self that he saw in this experience, in this quote unquote alien experience.
Right.
So to me, that's it. You know, it's like there are these threads that, that you hear now and then and that maybe you feel sometimes about, well, the familiarity, you know what this is, you know.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, we talked about that.
We've talked about that. We've both had that experience of, oh, you just innately know what this is, even though you don't.
Right.
And a lot of people talk about that. And so, you know, one wonders, this one particularly, if, what do you, you know, what is this saying? If, I mean, it's tempting to make a narrative up here of this and say, well, this whole living in a physical vessel is just a phase or a stage or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that prior to this, you know who these people are. And when you die, you go back to knowing who they are. And essentially, right. You're a kid. Maybe you're all kids. Who knows? But whatever it is that you've grown into here on Earth ain't what you really are. And the only right. way you know that is when you have those moments of having your adulthood stripped from you. That's when you know who you really are. And you really are be as the children. You really are the children. It's just that you've forgotten that because you've grown up.
But, well, you've
that's
maybe
the
you,
part, but that's the part that you yeah. connect with these beings because that's who you are to them,
right?
Because that's and, who you are.
Well, and maybe the reason for so much panic and fear in the presence of these beings or seeing the craft at close up or whatever, maybe all of that is, you know, you've grown up in this world where such things are not true, and you feel like you have this ultimate toehold on reality that in fact you really don't have. And so when that other place starts to creep in, it's disintegrating this place. It's disintegrating what makes sense here. And so I don't know if you lived in a world – I mean just think of it this way. If you lived in a world where absolutely anything was possible, absolutely anything. You could walk out your front door and fly away if you wanted to. And then – you decide you want to leave that and you go to a place where there are rules and there are good times and bad times, good people and bad people, and you grow up in that and you become accustomed to it and it becomes what you know. It becomes what is stable for you. And then that other world where anything is possible, all of a sudden one day presents itself to you and you don't remember it because you've become so accustomed to this that this is what you know as real. This is what you know as reality, and this is – where your home is and your loved ones and all of that. And when this thing shows up, all of that shit just disintegrates. And for that brief instant, almost nothing else seems to be of any importance at all. That's what's the most strange to me about thinking of this in terms of like Whitley was talking about seeing the dead with these aliens. And of course you could extrapolate that 10 different ways. What does that mean? What does that imply? But, you know, I was on Facebook Saturday, and how we got into talking about this was a lady named Rita, who's a friend of mine on Facebook. Hi, Rita, if you're listening. You know, she mentioned she had an experience the night before, and she had a little mark on her hand and was kind of freaked out about it. And she made the statement in there that I realized to a degree what this is, and then used some kind of word like some kind of verbiage like soul bargain or soul deal or something like that. Like this is a deal we made before we were born. And I can't tell you how many people over the years that I've heard say that. I've never read it in a book. I've never seen a documentary where anyone talks like that. You just hear this, and every so often you'll hear it from an experiencer saying, I get the feeling I made some kind of bargain. Like this is part of what I signed up for, and this is what they tell me.
But you don't read those books anyway, so how would you know?
I mean, I've never. I mean,
now that you're saying that, I'm thinking like John Mack probably has that in his books.
He might. Yeah, I've never read any of his. I mean, I've leafed through plenty of them, but it's like I don't sit down and actually digest a lot of stuff. But I mean, back when I was first looking into this stuff, I read a decent amount of books, predominantly about sightings and not so much abduction stuff. But, I mean, all that aside, I've never heard this in a mass sense talked about. I'm sure it has been at some point, but you hear this from a lot of people who otherwise had never had an experience before. A lot of people that I met back 10, 15 years ago who were reporting missing time or a full-blown experience with a UFO who had never had one before. And there were a couple who had never had any sort of weird experience before, ever, who actually came out and said stuff like this and said, I don't know why, I just get the feeling like I asked for this, or I somehow, you know, this is something that I signed up for. And I've spoken before about, you know, waking up in the middle of the night with some little guy scratching my arm with a stick, and instead of, you know, becoming terrified, I just instantly became angry and, said, what are you doing? And he says, I don't know, something like, you know, I'm doing my job, you know, I'm a volunteer, you're a volunteer too, you know, so I didn't volunteer for shit, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yes, you did. And I heard that probably 4, 5, 6 months later, I heard that from a guy speaking at a MUFON meeting. So the exact, almost the exact scenario. And my wife just lost her breath and she's like, you got to talk to this guy. And he said, yeah, that's what he said. I don't know what it means, but I don't know if I feel that's true. But that is what the thing said to me, that he was a volunteer and so was I. So I don't know what to make of that, but it's certainly, I mean, where were you before you were here? There's a question to ask yourself, you know. If you believe in reincarnation or something like that, then you were somebody else. But seems like there should be a between period there. And where were you before you come forth from the womb? I don't know. Is that where this deal gets made? I don't know.
I think, didn't Lee, I don't want to mention anything that Lee hasn't said on the show, but I think he said, right, that at the end of his big finale experience, he said, oh, it's you, right?
Correct, yeah.
On the show? Yeah, so it was like...
Yeah, he did.
He sees, I don't even remember what, a being?
Well, he saw a light outside, I think, something like
whatever
that.
Whatever it was, the beginning of the onset of this phenomena, his reaction is, oh, it's you. And he has no idea why he would even think that or say that, and yet there it is. But anyway, I just think it's fascinating, because when I think of adulthood, I think, you know, we grow into protectors. We grow into, you know, sort of autonomous existence, or so we like to think. And at least in America, we don't have a real sense of unity or community. You know, we don't have like one sort of community. I mean, there are pockets of people that have a good sense of community, but overall, not so much. I mean, at least I don't, here in New York. Really it's like you're on your own and you're supposed to be smart and you're supposed to, but you're not. But even all of that stuff is like even looking online and seeing how people bully each other, and you know, it just never gets any better. It's like you think that it gets beyond high school and it never really does.
That's true, yeah.
So even that's a lie, you know? Like, it's just like these various phases of lying, but all of those lies are what we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. In a way, I kind of think like dementia and all that. It's like, geez, why do people get dementia and, you know, and all these sort of brain diseases? Well, gee, I don't know. Maybe because we spend our lives with our defenses up all the time and don't even know we do it. We just call that existence.
Yeah, that's possible.
I don't know.
I remember working with two women when I first, I think it was one of my first design jobs, was doing space planning and architectural rendering for this pair of ladies out of Texas that they had moved up to Maryland, started an interior design business. And I was talking to them one day about, you know, high school. God, I was so glad to be out of high school, because now there's no more drama and there's no more games and there's no more of that childish fighting and arguing. And they just looked at each other and started laughing. They said, oh, it's just getting started. I was like, really? I mean, like, aren't we adults now? Does that not stop? And she's like, oh no, it just gets more vicious. It may be a little bit fewer between, but it's far more vicious than you could ever imagine when you're out of high school, you know? And I was like, wow, really?
Well, it's like, you know, we talk about how things are out of whack, how you take a look around out of whack. And I feel like the whole existence of us is out of whack. Like the the whole nature of communication, you know, gossiping and just even just reiterating what you did during the day. Like, I don't understand why that's important. I do it. You know, everybody does it, but it's like, what are we communicating? I mean, after a while, it's like you look back on millennia of this and you go, what are we doing? What is this for? Why we've got this tool? Are we using it correctly? Like, what is this? And then you've got this phenomena that sort of comes along and says, you're not even you. You know, this adult shell of a person isn't even who you are. So let's not worry about what communication is. But even in that, isn't it interesting that the attitude is sort of this sarcastic, rough kind of humor, as opposed to gently explaining to us what's going on?
Right.
And I wonder what that's about. I'm tempted to say that's because the person that they're talking to isn't important. You know, if it's not really you, if you're not really that adult, then it doesn't matter how they treat that adult. You only think it does because you think you're the adult, but it doesn't. Or, I mean, could it just be as simple as they know what we don't know and they find that amusing? And it's like, wake up, dummy. You know, it'd be like torturing someone who's just not bright enough to get it or has amnesia or something. You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know. I mean, if you look at even nurses who take care of, you know, say mentally retarded people,
right?
You've got to have this sort of sense of humor about it. Granted, that's got to be more of a gentle sense of humor.
Oh, yeah.
But there's always got to be that, oh, that person doesn't know what he's doing. We got to take care of him sort of. Right. Humor about it, because, you know, even mentally retarded people can get violent and all that.
Sure, yeah.
So do you think that's sort of what that is about? That sardonic sense of, yeah, just wake up, dude, deal with this. Just freaking deal with it.
Mm.
You know what this is, deal with it. Or even as they say to Whitley, you know, we have a right. And he goes off and says, you know, what right could they possibly have? Well, what is the word? And I guess, you know, in the book, I think it was communion where they said this, you know, he gets hung up on what is the word, what does right mean? What could that word mean to them and to him?
Yeah.
And I think everybody gets hung up on that when you talk about it. It's like, yeah, what right do they have? What right? But then the rub here is that maybe we're asking the wrong question first. Maybe the question is, who are we that they have a right to anything in the first place? You know what I mean? Because I think that's the implied question. Not how do you have a right to do something to me, but wait, let's really step back here and say, okay, well, who are we then? I mean, how could you make such a statement? We have a right. Because I think the implication is that you now need to be on the defensive because there's somebody who is, you know, barging in on your rights and saying we have a right like a dictator. But what if it's not that? What if it's simply, oh, yeah, we have a right because we made an agreement and you don't know this because you've got this stupid amnesia that we can't understand or that we do understand and find kind of humorous, and you'll get it too when you die. Just right now it just sucks, but you'll get the joke when you die.
Right, right. Well, I guess there's two questions, really. The question is, what are we? And then the other question would be, what did we do? I mean, when you're talking about this, I can't help but be reminded of what was it, Hellraiser 2, where, you know, the Cenobites, the lead Cenobite, Pinhead, says to the girl Kirsty, who's in the first movie, she says, "No, I didn't mean to open the box," and, you know, and he's like, "What was it the first time? Didn't know what the box was. Yet we do keep meeting each other, don't we?" And it just almost seems like that kind of thing. Like, no, you don't understand. You made the deal. You called us here. You made the deal. And so we have every right to do what we want to you. We have every right to force feed you fear to make you get past it. We have the right to wake you up out of your everyday mundane life, which could be called a numb life, for lack of a better way to describe it. So maybe it goes back to what you had said early on, which was something trying to wake us up into a larger reality, because to add us into the mix makes them larger. It's all part of the same thing. And maybe it's just growing And that's what is meant. I mean, maybe it's a, I don't know, some kind of consciousness Borg or some shit like that. But maybe adding to itself in the nature of waking people up, no matter how difficult that may be. I mean, why the sardonic humor? Why the? When Dennis talks about the teacher from down in La Chirera when they were tripping their balls off, you know, every day of the week, eating, you know, psilocybin mushroom omelets. The teacher was described, if he could put a persona to it, it was like a praying mantis, but very much like a school marm, like a knuckle cracking teacher. You know, what's 2 + 2? 5. Whack. What's 2 + 2? That sort of thing. At least that's the way I took it and how I described it. But that does seem to be the attitude, and maybe there is a – I mean, have you not always had the sense in your experiences with, let's just say, with what you would term alien phenomena? Have you never had the sense during it that there is a sense of urgency to, by the way, urgency available on Amazon.com.
Yes.
Have you ever not had the sense that there is an urgency to them? Like, we've got to come do this and then we've got to go. Like, we've got a deadline here. Have you ever had that kind of vibe at all from this?
I've never thought about it in those terms, but if I think back to the high school thing of something walking into my room and babbling at me, the rate at which it was babbling and how it walked into the room was very quick. So, yeah, I mean, in that sense, it's like there was a rush to get into the room and it's going bop, 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 bobbing its head around. That's all fast. So there is a sense of speed there. There's a sense of urgency in the voice of whatever this woman is.
Okay.
But I don't know. I guess I always interpreted the urgency as sort of this sort of compassionate, you got to get this sort of thing for our sake, not for, you know, that was the urgency and the time constraint, not that they've got this window of opportunity.
See, that's exactly what I got. On more than one occasion. I mean, I would say most pronounced in the experience that Lisa and I had up in the country where I mentioned to you last night, where we saw the disc and I stood up in the field and boom, the lights came on and all of that, which I've talked about a billion times, so I don't need to go over that again. But that was the most urgent sense that I can remember of – and to me, if we wanted to get into classic abduction lore, I mean, that was the classic thing. I'm on some kind of flat surface. It's very cold. It's very bright. My eyes are shut. I'm not opening them. There's two people there. I can clearly tell there's two people there. And their vibe was one very angry, very terse. The other one almost like a guardian angel type figure. One being, open your eye. God damn it, open your eye. That kind of attitude. And the other one being, you know, do you want to hold my hand? Will that make it easier for you? That sort of thing. But between the two of them, you could tell there was this underlying current of, we don't have this kind of time. We don't have time to fool around here. We don't, you know, this is of the utmost importance to get done and get gone. And so there was that definite air to it, and I've experienced that a couple of times.
Well, I guess, you know, the October 2001 experience where they were, like, at my bed.
Yeah.
And then the next thing I know, I'm staring at this row of tables with people on them.
Right, right.
I mean, you could think of that, I suppose, in those terms of why did it go from point A to point B so quickly? Why is there no, hey, how you doing? Or no even remembrance of a sedation process because I was freaked out in my bed, but once I was standing there, I'm thinking, you know, why am I seeing this? I'm completely sedate. And then I have this conversation with this woman in my head or telepathically or whatever. What's the rush? What's the rush to present this scene to me?
Yeah.
And say, look, this is what we do for a living, whatever the hell this is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess you could interpret that, too, along those lines.
Yeah.
It's like we've got to do X, Y, Z and then in, out, by.
Well, I've I mean, I got the very strong sense, like I said a couple of times, that it wasn't just about it wasn't anything about getting caught or being seen. This was about if we don't get this done and get back to wherever the fuck this all originates or whatever the source of this is, if we can't return to that source, then we can't return at all. And this will all cease to be. Like it was that dire to me in the way that I interpreted it. And that could be incorrect. I could be completely off with that.
Well, do you think that this is the nature of the experience you had with the being that was sort of going back and forth, trapped in the fractal, sort of like a recording?
Yeah.
Now, Do you think that you were actually witnessing that happen, or do you think that that was an answer to the question?
I think that was just an answer to the question. I think that was showing me a very psychedelic framework, literally, and saying, you know, we are contained within this. This is one possible path. This is one possible conduit. And however that played out, I mean, I think that was an answer to that, and it was also an answer to my whole thing of how real is it when it's visionary, when it begins as visionary, and that very much began as a completely visual experience that was not very clearly not present in the room. Were you to stand there with a camera, you would not have seen the fractal pattern that I saw. That was clearly internal. And yet, when I fixated my vision on a part of the room where I could see these very clearly, which was the stairwell, and this thing began emerging out of it, and then the hand comes out and hits the wall, and it makes a definitive sound on the wall, and you can see the solidity of that touching the wall, then I'm thinking, how does this thing go from a visionary experience to something that's capable of reaching out and touching a physical object and interacting with that in enough sensibility to it to make a noise? That's what is the leap for me. That's where I can't figure out what, like, there's magic in between there, like, somewhere. There's something going on there that's not, for me, is not conceivable. Like, how does this begin in the head and end in the floor? But that is how it seems to work.
Well, or even, you know, I think about the when I was, for lack of a better term, possessed by some sort of red gargoyle-looking thing, and seeing it superimposed over me. I mean, now, if someone walked into the room, would they just see me gnashing my teeth and curling up my hands and being crazy?
Yes.
Probably they would. So my question is, how is it possible that I opened my eyes and saw this thing not just superimposed over my hand and my arm, but, I mean, I could see its face just above my own face. You know, I could see its teeth. You know, it was superimposed over me, this thing.
From your visionary point?
How is that possible? You know, how is it possible that my eyes are picking this up if it's not there? And then if it's just simply, well, you hallucinated, then why aren't I crazy? And why is it so specific to a slit opens up, a thing comes in, the three times that a slit opened up and energy came in?
All those precursory things that precipitated all of that. I mean, that seems to be like a constant. The slit opens up. You have this, you know, all of that kind of falls in line. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that.
Eyes picking up something that isn't there, that other people aren't picking up? That's just crazy.
Well, I mean, it's not to say it's not there, but that I don't know that, you know, ocular stimulation necessarily means there's something there to be visually perceived. You know, I mean, let's really be honest about the nature of perception. When you're talking about seeing something with your own eyes, that just means you're seeing it with your own brain, not with your own eyes. Your eyes are just, you know, the visual input, you know, the input of light bouncing around. And so I don't say that there's anything that we perceive that isn't perceived by the mind. It's all psychological when you really get down to it.
But there's no denying that there are objects in this room that I am looking at right now, my computer.
Sure.
And
but when you're talking
about the computer and everyone can see my arm, then when this thing happens, only I can see something superimposed over my arm, but no one else can, presumably?
Right.
I mean, how does that work?
Well, I don't know.
How does the internal suddenly, I mean, it's the same question you have. How does the internal project something become, outwardly?
Right.
And then,
so that you actually believe that you're seeing something like that, but is it really that it's something that's being superimposed over somewhere between the eye and the brain, if that makes any sense, or directly into the brain rather than...
And then the big monkey wrench is that, as we've seen with the psychedelic trips, or the ayahuasca trips at least, mm-hmm. that there is evidence that at least sometimes multiple people see the same thing.
Right, exactly.
So what are we saying here?
I don't know. I mean, this gets into the nature of what is perception and what do we mean when we say, I saw this or I experienced this. What are you actually saying? I mean, where do you draw the line between, you know, visual shared data that everyone can see versus the subjective? And then you've got this whole other thing with in regards to the UFO, which is how do people in a particular area or a particular line of sight, how are they able to see something such as Ted Phillips and Marley Woods seeing these objects from a certain vantage point only? Lisa and Cody and I in the park seeing this silver ball hanging in the air from one, literally two steps and it's gone, two steps back to the starting point and there it is. I mean, all of this being very almost like there's an invisible tube that you're looking down and it's just for you to look through. I mean, how do you explain that? How would anyone explain that?
Well, that I could, you know, I guess in some sci-fi way explain as, well, a little wormhole opens up, and if you're to the right or left of it, you don't see it.
Right, right. And I think, well, I mean, if you talk to David Rountree, I mean, he would tell you, you know, these wormholes can open in the mind. They can open in the brain. They could hit you. They could open in your living room. I mean, it's just like, what are we? We're being bombarded by wormholes? I mean, I don't know.
So I'm starting to wonder if what's going on here isn't like when you you take a fish in a bag, and if you're going to transport it into a new fish tank, sometimes one thing you can do is plop that bag in so that the water temperature, you know, it's still in its own water, so it feels mm-hmm. safe, mm-hmm. but the temperature evens out with the giant, you know, tank, right. and then you pop the bag and the fish goes out and then he lives in the larger environment.
Right.
Is that what this is? Are we
well,
the fish?
And then, and now, now imagine that fish in the little fish tank with lots of other fish, and they are very used to the environment that they now inhabit. And then one day, Jeremy comes into the pet store and buys a fish, and he gets removed. And then, well, now I don't have enough cash to pay for the fish, and you got to put the fish back. And now that fish, boy, doesn't he have a tale to tell. And now the rest of the fish think he's crazy. You know, God, they pulled me out. There was all this light, and they were these strange-looking people, and they examined me, and they tried to put me in a bag and take me away, but I escaped, and now I'm back with you guys. He's a little crazy fish, isn't he?
Well, that's one thing, except that that implies that they had to put you back, and that's it. You know, a mistake was made, right. I mean, this is a repeated, you know, this is a lifetime of stuff, and so I wonder if the lifetime of stuff isn't getting us acclimated to a larger environment that... Mm-hmm. Every now and then, you know, rips through, or we rip through into, or something. You know?
Right, right. I mean, you had mentioned something last night that I thought was good, which is, you know, back into this revisit of childhood air that seems to be within the alien experience. You said something like maybe we think that we've grown up and that we've matured until we are faced with something that is even infinitely more mature and infinitely more wise than what we are. And perhaps that's the reason for that kind of mouth gaping fear and awe to a certain degree. I mean, is I think how you put it. And the more I thought about that today, I was like, you know, that's probably pretty true. I mean, how would you feel just being a ordinary schlub from, you know, middle America or, you know, raised up on a farm and a farm is all you ever knew. And then all of a sudden you were transplanted into, you know, Shaolin temple or something like that. I mean, you know, you're meeting people who are much more versed in a particular way of life that you've never known. And to a certain degree, you would be awed by that, and you would be in fear of that to a certain degree, because now you're in their charge. You're not you're not down there, cleaning up cow patties and scrubbing out the barn and doing your chores, and then at night you don't go out for your beer with your buddies and stuff like that. I mean, daily life and daily routine is completely interrupted by that, and it's interrupted by something much infinitely more wise and old than you are. I mean, I think it could be all this stuff that generates that kind of feeling. I think I'm seeing a lot of interesting theories that have been brought up lately on other places on the net that I've been kind of hopping around to. And one of them came up on Ritz Reynolds' blog at RRR Group, which was looking at this from like this quantum viewpoint of is the UFO a large quantum particle? And while that sounds great to me on a certain level, on another level, it seems completely reverting back to like a materialist, like how can we fit this into some sort of box, even though it's a theoretical box? Because there's so much more to just the UFO. It's just so much more to it than that, in terms of how it interacts with us, in terms of what follows it, in terms of the framework that surrounds paranormal events. All of these things seem to be missing from that equation to me. So I don't know. I got no good answer for why it makes you feel that way, other than guesswork and kind of expounding that those ideas and what it could be.
Well, I mean, I also think that we got to take into consideration where humanity is at this point, or at least where the Western world is.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if we treat it differently now. Because again, there's this other sort of the Jacques Vallée thread that I keep trying to pull on, which is that, you know, way back when, it has to do with our cultural sort of sense of history and sense of the future, you know, and that way back when we didn't have the sense of the future that we have now, right?
Right.
It was all just sort of like wars and getting along to get along and, you know, conquering other nations and stuff like that. Right. And so as a result, people see wars in the sky.
Uh-huh.
And then something comes down as visions of, you know, they interpret as the Virgin Mary or, you know, gnomes or whatever.
Right.
And then we sort of reset ourselves. It's like there's this little turning point where suddenly we have science fiction, and suddenly we are thinking forward. Suddenly our imagination isn't just building myths, you know, about half snake, half human people and Zeus and gods and all this. We're using our imagination not to create Fantasy Island in the clouds above, but to project a future where we're going to meet beings and where you know, that we consider that reality, right? So that it's not just these gods that are sort of hanging around manipulating us. We've sort of taken that bit of imagination and gone, let's expand that out. Let's say we're going to go to other planets, and now let's explore that in our imaginations.
Right.
And so we have this sense of the future, of expanding out of Earth, you know, out of the territory. And territorialism, but we still bring that sense of our own territorialism with us. And, of course, all of our fears and anxieties and our space brotherly wishes and all of that.
Right.
So when we actually make it into the clouds, we see that, no, there aren't dragons up there, and there are no Virgin Marys up there, and there aren't wars happening. And so suddenly we start seeing something again. We start seeing something that is mimicking where we are in our own heads. Where we are in our own heads is projecting toward the future, toward space travel, and toward meeting space brothers and or enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So we start seeing that in the form of objects or things that we interpret as objects. And then those things start coming down in the form of aliens or things that we interpret as aliens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same goddamn scenario playing out. It's like once we discover what's not there, then this thing sort of fills in the gap based on where we are. You know, culturally. Well, where are we now? So now we're at a place, I think, where we sort of still think that that's possible, right? That we could do all of that, but it's more, you know, we're more toward the new physics of, well, it's all interdimensional. It's all going to happen instantaneously. There's not going to be a long space flight somewhere. It's going to be just a wormhole opens up and you step through.
Mm.
So now here we are with this thing mimicking that, maybe? I don't know.
I mean, in the sense of things being suggested, which is really what that is. I mean, in every instance that you're talking about there, you're talking about whatever the phenomena is, it is ultimately making suggestions. It is suggesting ideas. It is putting forth ideas and concepts, whether we realize that or not. I mean, when you're talking about seeing an object move at such ridiculous velocity and trajectory that it seems impossible, then I think immediately some people in the world, based on that information, whether they think it's true or not, maybe begin to explore those possibilities of, can we do that? Can we achieve that? And so it's these maybe even subliminal suggestions of what can happen and what will be. And so in that regard, does it act like a mirage? Is that kind of what that boils down to, is some kind of mirage in time, as McKenna was talking about? But I mean, don't forget what Graham Hancock said about early man. I mean, you know, it was stick figures on the cave drawings, and then all of a sudden, mankind over the course of a very short period of time became infinitely more interesting. And the question, you know, I mean, some people put that to mankind and his search for food and his quest for survival stumbled upon a psychedelic that then inspired his creativity. His creativity exploded by virtue of that. And this is something that people involved in psychedelics talk about all the time, that it enhances creativity. It kicks your creative drive into overdrive. And so is that a possibility? That's a possibility. And of course, we've already talked about, what does a psychedelic experience mean? What could it mean? Is there something external there that is being met by the use of a compound? And of course, the other possibility is, was he simply influenced by nothing more than what we experience now as a UFO? Did he experience something so completely radically different from his everyday existence that it in turn set off his creative drive to, you know, a stick figure is no longer enough. Now I have to do these form. There's form and there's color, and it's almost like mankind's brain made some kind of something tweaked and snapped the animalism out and put in what we know as culture.
And, well, I guess the point I'm getting at here is almost the opposite, which is it that we're tweaking naturally, uh-huh, and this thing is conforming with it, so that we're at a point now where we couldn't have possibly been with this hundreds of years ago, or even thousands of years ago. I mean, it's not as though we don't have the ability anymore to see battles in the sky, because they just uh-huh simply don't exist and we know it.
Uh-huh.
And we're not going to, I mean, if you see a UFO, it's not challenging you in a way that is religious. It may challenge you spiritually, but as a Westerner who right knows it all, you know, an intellectual, blah, blah, blah,
uh-huh,
you're not going to form a cargo cult out of it, because uh-huh that's not who you are anymore. You know, you're not gonna erect temples around it and go, "Ooh, this is God."
Right, I got you. Yeah.
So we're now at a place where we've got this sense of individualism, we've got this sense of forward thinking, we've got this sense of wanting everything now, and we've got this, well, this isolation, right? We've got this isolation, this intellectualism. I mean, what do you do with it? And it seems like, I mean, this visage of little gray, boring aliens with ships that don't seem to do anything, and interior design that sort of, you know, queer eye for the straight guy could probably do something better with.
Okay.
I'm just saying, I mean, you know, it's like these drab interiors. There's nothing particularly sci-fi about any of it. It's actually, I think you could make a better argument that it is mimicking the sort of dead, homogenized interior of us, in a way.
Wow.
So if that goes away, if we wake up and realize that, if it's true, then what happens? Then, I mean, I guess I've probably asked this on another show, but I mean, if you just wake up out of it and you go, you know what, let's start over. What happens? Does it reset itself again based on the fact that you know? I mean, once you know that that can't be what it is, just like you know it can't be battles in the sky or dragons, then what does it become? And if you're so awake to the process that anything it becomes, you're going to know it's not that, then can it become anything at all? And then does the bag pop, and then are you in the larger environment?
Huh. Well, I mean, again, good question. I have no good answer for it.
But do you feel like we're at almost at that point, just culturally?
Well...
I mean, is that the thing also that, that is so frightening to us particularly as opposed to, say, Teokas and Ghost Horse, the Lakota, the Kogi, the, any of these sort of tribal nations who take this stuff in stride and, you know, as you said, you know, Indians don't get abducted. Well,
right.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly funny. I mean, it's certainly a bold statement, and it certainly makes sense from this point of view, which is that... whatever this phenomena is going to be different for different cultural points of view. And our cultural point of view is that, again, we project the future, and I think we're at a point now where, because of our imaginations and because of what we can actually achieve on the silver screen, I think, in terms of special effects, we've already visualized where we can go in a way never before seen. That I feel that we have internalized that to believe that we know we're going to figure everything out at some point, which is probably not true, but it's something that we feel we're going to do. It's, I mean, I almost have the sense of the feeling of every, you know, everything's been done before. Like, we've already done everything, and it's just a matter of time before reality catches up. You know, we've already traveled other planets in these movies and the such. We've already got this fantastic technology light years ahead of what we actually have. It's just a matter of time before reality catches up. And so I think when you have that sort of confidence and you have something that when you come into contact with it, it doesn't just wipe out the adult. It wipes out that sense of infinite security, that sense of, I know.
Right. Right.
And when that's wiped away, I mean, no wonder we're so fucking scared.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, it's your toehold on reality. It's your toehold on what you know, what you're comfortable with.
But we wouldn't have had that sense of reality 100 years ago, even.
I don't know if I buy that. I mean, 100 years ago, I don't know. I think even still, whether or not, you know, everything was as stable and as easy, let's just say as easy as it is today, because let's face it, life is easier today in many ways than it was 100 years ago for people. But nevertheless, I mean, 100 years ago, even 200 years ago, I mean, yes, there's a certainty in, you know, the sun coming up in the morning and the sense of where you are in the world and political upheaval and wars and stuff like that. Sure, that's a level of uncertainty, but I think even back then, I think people had a certain amount of a semblance that they knew what the world was about and they knew what was going on. I mean, there was probably more to discover in terms of not only energy and inventions, but land. You know, what is on the other side of the ridge, that sort of thing. I mean, I'm sure that was around, but I think people had a pretty good toehold on what they thought everything was about. They were just in a much different place than we are now. I mean, in a religious sense, in a cultural sense. But I don't see that people didn't have that firm toehold. Like, I think we've always had that. No matter where you reside on the planet, your life being as short a span as it is. In the grand scheme of things, I think people do get comfortable. I think that's where this all comes from, is the nature of life and routine and being consumed with the world and what it takes to be here, you know?
I agree with that, but I think that we've expanded because we took our imaginations away from the here and now, right? The here and now being gods. And, you know, magic and knights and whatever, all that stuff. magical thinking. That's sort of the here and now. And okay. we projected it toward the future and said, so if we were certain about how things worked in the here and now, which is, oh, yeah, we've got these gods that control everything, or we've got God and Jesus that controls everything or whatever. Well, we took that that sense of security and projected it onto the future, because suddenly we had this different sense of the future that expands outward, upward and outward, as opposed to just territorial on the globe.
Okay.
And so we brought that false sense of control of, well, we can already imagine, you know, every horrible and every great thing that's going to happen once we meet E.T.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's a form of control. It's the same form of control. It's the same form of, okay, I know what's going to happen, so I'm fine. I'm in charge of this.
Right.
And I feel like that's, I don't know, that there's something, I mean, that's so mentally ill that that it's got to be more frightening now. Because yeah. at least before you could be like, oh, this is the devil, or oh, this is a god, or some, you know, they did, right? They said, oh, this is a Marian vision, or oh, these are demons.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
You can categorize and go, okay, I know what this is, based on the here and now. Well, we don't have those categories. I mean, some people do, but by and large, we've abandoned that, and so, you know, now we categorize this as, oh, this is the good alien, this is the bad alien.
Okay. Well, not to throw a monkey wrench in here, but I mean, you bring up the soldiers, the battle in the sky type of thing, and how we don't see that anymore. And I don't know if you heard Unknown Country this week, but the guest is Chris Albach, who was the co-author of Wonders in the Sky with Jacques Vallée. And that was brought up in the interview, you know, the battle of these soldiers in the sky and the clouds, so on and so forth. And you know, Chris had said that he takes stories like that with a very huge dose of salt, that he doesn't put nearly as the kind of importance on that as he would the other stuff. And see, I was a big believer in the progression of the unknown relating to us throughout time. I mean, I always thought it was gremlins and fairies, and then it was aliens, and now what's going to be next? And you know, and in 100 years from now, when people still don't know what this is, are they going to be saying, well, we see this thing now? I mean, back in the 1980s to the 2000s, it was the year is of the alien. Before that, it was fairies and gnomes, and this all goes back, but we still don't know what it is. I think the one thing that Wonders in the Sky did for me in reading that is that, in fact, yes, back in ancient times, before any sort of flight was known about, by man, that there was the cylinder craft, there was the triangular craft, there was the spherical craft, not necessarily known as craft, but described as a pearl, a rod, a cone, a disc. I mean, all of these things, this is not, that it kind of broke down my theory of that the appearance of the phenomena has changed over time, and it certainly seems to have in some ways. But in fact, what we see today is being seen or was being seen back in these ancient times. And so what do you put to that? I mean, how do you reconcile that with a progression in what people actually see? Because like I said about the soldiers in the sky, I could easily say and compare that to was it Caesar who was allegedly attacked by flying saucers. I don't remember who it was. Was it Alexander the Great or Caesar? I can't, probably Alexander the Great. But, you know, his troops and him, they described this sighting of glowing shields in the sky. And so they described them as glowing shields, literally shields like they were carrying. But we would know that as definitely a disc today. We would know that as a flying saucer. So is the battle in the sky between soldiers a description used to describe something that they couldn't possibly put into words any other way through any other description?
Well, or did they actively see it? I thought some of what they were seeing were foot soldiers in the sky.
Yes. Yes. But is that really, you know, what was being seen? I mean, is that an accurate description verbally based on what was seen? How much of that is even translation? See, I don't know this. I haven't looked deeply in enough of that to know. And I don't know that we really kind of pressed on that question with Dr. Vallée when he was on, but certainly his co-author says, you know, I take those with a great deal of skepticism, because here you've got these modern day UFO craft being seen in ancient times, and then you've got stories like this that don't seem to quite fit into the same UFO category or label that we readily know. And so, I don't know. I mean, I've had, like we've talked about before, people have seen tractor trailers, the upside down Star Trek Enterprise, to a jellyfish in the sky that looked, for all intent and purposes, like a jellyfish in the sky. So there is still weird shit being seen that doesn't exactly categorize itself into the UFO enigma or label. So I don't know. I don't feel like I'm really all that sure anymore that this thing has evolved over time in its presentation. I think that the presentation, number one, can be somewhat subjective, but certainly when you're talking about a cylinder shape or a disc or a cone or a triangle, those things have been seen since ancient times and described in a myriad of different ways, no doubt.
Well, I don't see why it can't be a little one, a little a two. I mean, there are a finite number of shapes we're going to be able to see. Mm-hmm. And so if something is flying around up there,
yeah,
it's going to be one of those shapes.
I mean, I wonder, as far as the foot soldiers in the sky and I think even in Jacques' book, there was something about seeing a building being attacked in the sky or something like that. Something about that, I wonder is, and you notice what kind of surrounded those foot soldier things. This was the eve of war, or this was during battle. And I wonder how much of that actually could go back to like an Angel of Mons type of story, where this is a story that's evolved over time. Based upon maybe a complete hallucination of, you know, a guy who is scared to death of battle and is looking for that sign that he's going to be okay, or that they're going to win the battle, or what have you. Or is it a story that was generated by the culture of the time to kind of say, yay, our side won because there was this prophecy in the sky that said this? And is that where that comes from? See, I don't know that I would throw that into the UFO mix as far as making the case of an evolution of perception over time by us.
Except I think, at least for the first point of that, he did say that these things were written down as they happen.
As they happen, yeah. Yeah.
And records were meticulously kept. But that still doesn't mean that it wasn't the second part of what you're saying, which is, you know, maybe it was a false prophecy to say, you know, this is why we're going to win, or this is why we won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, really, it's sorry to say this, but we don't know. I mean, all we can do is look at some wrinkled up documents and go, well, maybe this is what
they saw. I think the path of least resistance there is, again, the projecting out of, you know, if you're in the middle of battle and you see a battle in the sky,
right,
you know, above, are you projecting your fears onto that tapestry? And yet, it's everyone seeing it, right? I mean, and you would think that if that were happening and everyone were seeing it, that both sides would have recorded it if it were not just a prophecy.
Yeah, you would think.
Yeah, we should have asked him that, huh?
We should have. Yeah. Was that a Fatima event where, you know, so many miles away they didn't see anything, but yet the sun is dancing around in the sky for these, 100,000 people in that one spot, the sun is dancing around. So in a technical sense, the sun should be dancing around all over the earth, not just for this small group of people, small in terms of the population of the planet, in that place. So I don't know.
I don't understand Chris Aubeck's position, because you know, with the Marian visions, I mean, how does that have anything to do with modern ufology or objects seen in the sky?
I don't know. I mean, I even go back to the most fascinating one to me was the boy that was sent up river to give, what was it, breakfast or dinner to his father. He was fishing upstream, and then on his way back, he went through a shortcut in the woods and ended up in some palace with a guy who said, you know, come, you can sit down and eat with us. And he said no. And then it's like, get this guy away from me. And that whole encounter with this, with this strange place, with these strange people, and being offered something to eat, and then when he refused it, you know, he was thrown out. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, on the one side, you can say, well, there's a boy who got sent to do an errand, came home grossly late, maybe because he fell asleep because he was lazy and fell asleep, or he went to play with his friends, or he went to see his girlfriend, and he didn't want to admit to mom that that he was banging his girlfriend. And so let's make up this tall tale about being invited into a weird house with weird people and being told to eat food that he didn't want and out the door. Could it be that? Sure, it could be that. I don't think that's what happened, but I mean, what do you do with a story like that? There was nothing that was said like, build a church here or build a monument here.
Well,
I mean, that's like such a nonsensical event.
Yeah.
There's no purpose to that at all.
And now, Paratopia, watch me magically segue us into another topic and yet tying together all of these threads at the same time. You think I can do it?
Watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Because here's something we talked about last night, which is, well, let's put it this way. For the nuts and bolts crowd, explain to me the necessity of all the lights on these objects. The thing that I saw in Vermont was self-luminescent green. So the whole thing was emanating green. Plus it had these red and blue blinking lights. Plus it's spinning. Plus there are these windows. There's nothing inside the windows that I can see. So what is all of this pageantry about? Is there really a planet of these things that has all of these giant multi-lit objects on it for, I mean, what is the point of all of that light except to attract attention? So if you're talking about they saw shields in the sky 1,000 years ago, and you're saying, well, that's clearly the modern day UFO. Au contraire, mon frère, I would say maybe that's a type of something. Maybe we're making a wrong conclusion there, because are they describing something that had strobing effects on it? Are they describing something that had windows in it? Something that brightly lit that is an object? I don't know. I don't know that these are the same thing. I mean, maybe this is our own postmodern arrogance to say that we know we've got the real visual of what these people in their sort of ignorant way were trying to describe. You know, they tried to call them shields when clearly they were this craft. Except that this craft, the closer you look at this craft, the craft doesn't make sense either. So, what do you do with that? I mean, if the craft doesn't make sense, then it's not a craft. If the shield didn't make sense, then it wasn't a shield. So maybe they did see a shield. Maybe we're seeing a craft. And none of them are really what we're seeing. Unless someone, again, can explain to me the need for all of this. I mean, I guess they could, you know, what would you even need? Like, even flying through space or interdimensional, you don't need lights, right? I mean, you're just popping in and out of somewhere. Going across space, what do you need to glow in case there is some other person jettisoning through space? I mean,
let me play the devil's advocate with that. I mean, I for the life of me, I cannot explain all of the different variations of craft that have been seen. I mean, there's been, out of all the sightings that have been happening and all the sightings that have gone down, how many of them can we really put down to being, yes, it's exactly the same craft, it's exactly this, it's the same description, but is it side by side, case by case, are they exactly the same object? We don't actually know that for an absolute fact. We have a few scant cases around town that conform to that, in a certain manner of speaking, like the McMinnville, and then there was another craft that was seen that was very similar to that. Could have been faked, may not have been. McMinnville certainly seems like a good case to me. As far as lights go, can we really define them as lights? I mean, what do you define? The fact that they're giving off light is could be a byproduct of whatever. I mean, if you're a nuts and bolts guy, is it a propulsionary effect? Is it Is it possibly something that whatever is in this thing, and you guys know I don't believe there's anything in them, is it something that is enabling whatever is driving to see? Is it a product of that? Is it a product of what's ever internally lit inside this thing? I mean, there could be many different reasons for why there is light involved with these craft. I mean, certainly people have seen the craft do things with light. Throw down a beam of light on water and the water rises up into the craft. What is that for? Ed Walters takes very good photographs of a craft that comes down in the sound down in Florida in Gulf Breeze, and it sucks water up in a tube. What is that for? Again, you could say, well, it's propulsion. Maybe they're cooling something with it, or maybe it's some sort of fuel. Or, I mean, to me, there's a million different reasons that someone can throw at you as to why these things have lights on them.
Well, but that's different. That's
the question is, are they lights?
That's throwing a beam down to do something. You're throwing a beam down to pick up water for what reason, we don't know. But you could try to figure it out, I guess. But in terms of just having landing lights on a craft, or having blinking lights, or having strobing lights,
uh-huh.
and it's just sitting there in the sky blinking these lights in succession.
Right.
Why the pageantry? I mean, what would be the necessity of that? I mean, those are lights. I mean, there's two different lights here. That one is that the craft is lit, and so maybe that's what you're talking about, the propulsion, or maybe there's that needs to be
there,
like that.
Yeah.
But what would the actual light bulbs that are going, I mean, why do those exist?
Right.
Why the windows with nothing in them?
Well, you're asking the question I asked a couple weeks ago, which is why the dog and pony show, or last show. Why the dog and pony show? I mean, clearly this goes back to why I say the ETH doesn't hold any water for me, is if they're coming this vast distance from another planet or another star system, if they've got that kind of technology, then certainly they can have the kind of technology so that they're not seen at all. Which speaks to your point of it's almost like they wish to be seen, or they wish to be gawked at. Let's put on a Pink Floyd light show for these people.
Yeah, we couldn't interpret their lights. We don't know what that. I mean, it's not like an airplane where everyone on Earth who knows anything about aviation is going to know what those lights mean.
Right.
No one's going to know what a freaking UFO sequential lighting system means.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So who is that for? It's not for us.
Mm-hmm.
So I would submit to you that
could it be
that
a communicative effort
that back then? They couldn't have been seeing that back then. They wouldn't mm-hmm. have had any reference for it. Our reference for it is, oh, that's a craft. That's the Jetsons. Mm-hmm. That's the future. Mm-hmm. That's aliens. That's all the shit that we're imagining when we project outward with our imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And when they don't do that, they see shields. But I know it's tempting to say, well, shield is the same thing as flying saucer. Saucers don't literally get up and fly.
Mm-hmm.
They're just describing the shape. But when you, I guess, poke more at what's beyond just the shape of a circle or a triangle or whatever, what is the actual object doing? Well, I don't know. It'd be interesting to know, are there any ancient accounts of an object blinking lights sequentially with windows and, mm-hmm. all of that sort of stuff that implies a craft? I don't know.
Well, I found here Alexander the Great, it was, by the way, that had the silver shields. It says Alexander the Great records two silver shields spitting fire around the rims in the sky that dived repeatedly at his army as they were attempting a river crossing. The action so panicked his elephants, horses, and men that they had to abandon the river crossing until the following day. And I'm sure there's actual description of that somewhere, which I probably can't find off the top of my head here. But it's two strange objects, and so it stopped them from crossing a river. So what? I wonder what would have been the point of making them not cross the river. Like, what does that mean? That was in 329 BC, by the way. So I don't know. I mean, certainly we've got UFO reports where there have been sparky-rimmed craft, sparky-rimmed UFOs, discs, that have been seen. Is it the same thing? I mean, who knows?
Hi, this is David Roundtree, author of Paranormal Technology, and you're listening to Paratopia.
If you record audio for any purpose, chances are you want it to be heard. You want to attract the largest audience possible who can hear your message. That's where we come in. We're CyberEars.com, a revolutionary internet service that will host your audio files and help you promote and track its popularity. Considering hosting a podcast to the world? We have all the automated tools to make the process as simple and easy as it can be. No technical mumbo-jumbo to work out. CyberEars.com does all the work for you. You record it. We take care of the rest. So don't delay. Go to CyberEars.com today and register for a free trial account. Upload your audio files and get heard. With CyberEars.com, it's your audio on your terms.
So the Jeff.
So the Jer, we're not done.
This isn't really an after chat, is it?
No, it's not.
It's just a further chat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're going to be able to hash out early man's visions of the UFO in one show, because the podcast really isn't a good way to communicate.
That's right.
But
thank you, George Hansen.
We love you, George. But you know, I mean, it's interesting to ponder this stuff and to try to I don't know, kind of fit it into some semblance of some kind of order. I mean, here's a really big problem for me, and this goes right down to your lights question. God, to probably every other question in this. And this is where I have a really big problem these days with ufology is everybody claiming too much information? I mean, when it comes down to how do we define the UFO phenomena, we're kind of at a serious – this is the biggest disadvantage to me, at least. Forget the crazy people. Forget the wannabes. Forget the hoaxers. Forget all of that. We don't really have a great way to define what is a project of our government's military defense, empire. How do we separate that from the UFO phenomenon? Both are equally interesting looking visually. I mean, when it comes to like something like the Phoenix Lights, the earlier sighting, the 830 one, I don't think it would be a huge stretch for anybody to say, could that have been something that our military has? I think people would say it could have been. As far as all this other stuff, in the modern ufological sense, in modern ufology, how do we draw that line between what is a secret project that we don't know about and are not familiar with versus the UFO? They're both unknown to us, and so we categorize them together, but they're really two different things. And then you've got experiences that are shared, and then you've got very subjective ones that exist within the UFO phenomena as well. So there's the line that has to be kind of whittled down in there. So it's really hard to study something that you're not quite sure. Where do you draw the line between these things? Because they're indefinable lines. We can't say what those are and aren't, because no one is privy to every black budgeted project that's flying around out there.
Well,
and certainly we know they do fly them over populated spots. It's not just the
– let's add this problem to the mix too, which is that the people oftentimes who are investigating this are the adults in the room. And if the phenomena has its say, that adult facade is not real, and that is what goes away. So
yeah,
there's the added problem of the delusion being the thing that is investigating the reality.
Right. Yeah.
And isn't that ironic on the face of it, just even saying it that way?
Sure. Yeah, sure, absolutely. And then take into consideration all the people that have probably pulled a pretty good – a snow job, and then you've got investigators out there who either A, want to make a name for themselves by pushing a fake case, or B, are just so snookered by this and so desperate to believe. I mean, there's also that big fight, which is everyone's desperate need to believe that there is a phenomena, that it is external, that it is this, and it all fits in nicely into my little worldview. And so we've got this mythology around ufology that's been going for its entire since the 40s. I mean, we've got that whole amount of baggage. So there's that. I mean, and there's every marketable area of multiple arenas of the UFO enigma that people kind of push or throw out there, and we end up with a binary code, or we end up with pictures of a Harco lid with Christmas balls on it, and we end up with, I mean, you can go on and on. Some of those things are very easy to toss out, but a lot of it, just at the baseline level, is not that easy to dismiss. But yet, how do we know what's actually being flown by the military? How do we know what is a subjective experience to one person? I mean, this is all very hard to kind of put your finger on and go, okay, that's what I'm going to study, because there's no line there. That's what becomes very, very, very complex and difficult to define, to try even to describe a meaning to. It's almost an insurmountable problem, because we're at a distinct disadvantage not knowing where to draw the line, or the multiple lines that have to be drawn in order to study at least one specific part of this, which is what I think we're interested in, which is the other. What is the other? And what can we throw out as not being that? And so that kind of ties nicely into the other topic that we talked about last night, which you brought up, which was how in a place like, just say, Gulf Breeze, how do people just move on from that? I mean, there's nothing going on down there right now. The flap or the rage has died down in that place, and people have kind of moved on. And
yeah, it's like a dream. It's like they all woke up from a dream and went, oh,
right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, how do you not have even a reporter doing a 10th anniversary or whatever, we're up 20th anniversary of, hey, guys, remember when this fucking happened?
Right, right.
I mean, nothing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, that's...
Remember when everybody in this room saw UFOs and videotaped them and photographed them? Everybody remember that? No? What happened?
Yeah. I mean, all those people that were so into it, you saw them on sightings, like every time they talked about Gulf Breeze, and here these people were, you know? Yeah, what are those people doing now? I mean, where did their lives go? I'll tell you what, if all of Gulf Breeze turned out to be a military project, fine. Where are those people right now, and what are they doing now that there is no more UFO in their lives? And how did it impact their lives while they were in it? That right there would be a great book and a great story.
Well, I'd love to know how many of them justified, like you had said, one of your friends asked you after you'd seen what was clearly lights, right? Blue strobing lights, was it, in the sky? What was the craft? Let's call it a craft. You see a craft with your friends, and you lose contact with your friends afterwards, and many years later you bump into one of them, and he says, do you think it could have been geese?
Yes, that's exactly what. Yes, that's exactly when we were up. That was actually the night of the Hale-Bopp cult suicide. That was the day that happened on the news, and you heard that break on the news that night. Two of my friends came into the shop and said, "Hey, have you been up on top of the hill, which is one of the highest places in the area? Have you seen this comet? It's unbelievable." And where we're talking about has little to no light pollution. And so the plume of this thing, I mean, it was unbelievable looking. And we're up there and gradually we start talking about the UFO thing. We start talking about, you think there's anybody else out there and blah, blah, blah. And then I start talking about, and both of my friends knew I had seen odd things in this area. And it all culminated in, probably the guy I was closer to, standing by my truck while me and another guy walked to the end of this little driveway, maybe, I don't know, maybe 40 feet away from him down this driveway. And to all of a sudden turning around, he's screaming blue murder because he had seen something previous to us all standing in a little triangular grouping at this one spot on the driveway. And he saw something and he pointed at it and he got real panicky looking. And I said, "Don't freak me out like that." And he said, "Oh, I saw something over there," and it turned, it went up on its side, and it went that way, and then I lost track of it. And so me and I'm just going to say Bob walked to the end of the driveway. I said, do you think he's bullshitting us? And he said, I don't know. He seemed kind of panicky. And then we hear him screaming. And as we turn around, here is this like manta ray shaped thing over top my truck, over top of him. He's pointing up at it, cussing a blue streak at the top of his lungs in a church parking lot. And there it is, a bank of blue lights on the front and a bank of blue lights on the back. And it hung there for, I don't know, 5-7 seconds. I mean, it wasn't short. It wasn't like we turned around and it skipped. It was there. We saw it hanging. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, 4 Mississippi, 5 Mississippi. And then it just kind of slides. It didn't fly. It didn't tip. It didn't waver. It just kind of went from a stationary position to whoo, like it was sliding on a piece of glass. And that's a very weird ass thing to see when you're used to seeing a balloon in the air or an airplane, or this is completely devoid of anything that you're visually used to seeing. It just takes on a very eerie appearance when it does this maneuver of sliding away. And by the way, sliding away and effectively the blue lights disappearing into darkness. So it dimmed out and went. And I would say, at least in my opinion, that right before it slid, it kind of brightened a bit and went away. Now, during that point, the goofball I'm standing with throws a little spotlighter, handheld spotlighter, up at it. And I knocked it out, knocked his hand. I said, are you crazy? I'll do that. But I could clearly see this thing was solid. It was matte, finished. It was dark. I mean, I hesitate to say that it looked like shark skin or like it was alive, but it did. It looked like it had texture of something like a skin. And matte black, matte dark blue. You couldn't really tell, I guess. It was just matte dark. And that guy was a mess. He was a mess. And this was normally a really calm and collected guy. And I remember him, I mean, I'll never ever forget how white he was, because it actually scared me, because I thought, could he pass out? Is he going to pass out right here in the truck? We left right after that. I mean, none of us wanted to stay. And we left, and as we're going down the road, he is smoking cigarettes at an astronomical rate, and he's shaking, violently shaking, his legs, his hands, his head. He's white, his lips are pale, and he's like, I know you told me about all this stuff, but it's real. It's all real. And he kept saying that over and over, and I said, yes, it's real. It's real, yes. And he goes, it wasn't that I didn't believe you, but it's there. I mean, I saw it. I know what I saw. I said, I know you know what you saw. We saw it too. And the one guy who was there with me at the end of the driveway, he really didn't have much to say about it. He was just kind of, I don't know, kind of dumbfounded acting about it, just like he didn't know what to say. And like I saw him sometime later, and he said, do you think that could have been geese? I said, geese don't glow blue. And geese don't slide. They fly at a consistent rate. Otherwise, they fall out of the sky. I think that was more – I guess, I mean, people hate living with things that they can't figure out and that they can't define. And I think maybe that was just how he was trying to define it to himself. He was trying to tell himself, I saw birds. That's what I saw. It was geese.
We rationalize it away.
We do,
so
yeah.
So that we can go on projecting the future and be in control.
Right. Right, right. You can't lose touch with what you know and what is true. And the other guy, I mean, we fell out of touch for, I don't know, a couple different reasons. I moved my shop, but I mean, you hang out with people for a while and then they just, you move on, and we kind of moved on, but I saw him years later and, you know, he said, yeah, it was weird, and, he didn't really think about it. I had told the both of them the best course of action from here on out is not to go up there again. Don't go looking for it. And I tried to kind of relate that, you know, I did that. I went up there. I saw something. I went back and saw more. And then things happen. And the guy I was saying that was so hysterical, he had come up to my house one night and we were talking about it. And, he was talking to Lisa about it, and I told Lisa by this time about it, and she's like, yeah, Jeff was telling me you guys saw something really bizarre, and it's not surprising. I've been there with him. There's been some very bizarre things up there. And then we started talking about, should we look into like the history of that area, and is there a history of sightings there and all of that? And I just said, dude, you don't want to poke at this, and you don't want to go chasing it. I know that it was a dumbfounding experience for you, but trust me when I say that you don't want what comes next, because what comes next is debilitating and it is harsh. And you saw something and be satisfied with that. And he said, well, we've already been up there four more times since then. I said, do you see anything? And he said, no. But he said that, he leaves that particular night. We had talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. And he took my advice and said, all right, I won't go up there anymore. And he left, and he left fairly late. But he called me when he got home, even later. Takes him about a half an hour to get home. And he says, I don't know what to say about this, but when I got home, the garage door was up. I said, is that unusual? And he goes, well, yeah, usually, you know, when Dad pulls in, he'll pull the door down. He'll, you know, or he'll push the button and the door will go down. And so I pulled in, you know, both the cars are in there, and mom and dad are home. They're in bed, and my brother's in bed. And I pull up in the driveway, and a ball, a basketball, bounces out of the garage at waist level or chest level. It's not rolling out on the ground. It's like someone has thrown it out of the garage. And I said, could it have fallen off a shelf? He was, well, it bounced right to me. It came right at me. And he said, I'm the only one that plays with it. I shoot some baskets, and there's a net that when I go in, I pop it into this net that is literally strung like a drawstring bag. It's not coming out of that bag, Jeff, and I know I put it in there. And no one would have bothered it. And it came bouncing out of there. And I said, well, I told you. If that wasn't a coincidence, you know, it's another hocus pocus moment, and it's knocking on the door. The answer is don't answer if you don't want more. And I think like many people back then in my life, the reason that they kind of extricated themselves from my wife and I was that it genuinely freaked them out. And there were other couples that would come into our home and see weird things or be out with us and have these flashes of light that would happen and not only happen out in the parking lot of whatever restaurant we ate at, but then we'd come back to the house and it would happen in the house. And I remember vividly the one couple saying, you know, the woman saying, I'm sorry, did no one just see that? I didn't see it. She did. My wife did. The other husband did. I didn't. And she's like, there was just another flash. She's like, I'm sorry, guys. I'm out of here. And they left. They never came back to our home again. We went to one more cookout that they had, and that was it for them. We never saw them again. And these were people we were hanging out pretty regularly with, and they were good folks. So I wonder, I said to you last night on the phone that I had a very sobering thought about taking people up to this particular place and showing them what I was seeing. And that was, you know, was that some kind of purpose to this? Was for me to see something there, to have an experience there, and then to bring others there to have the same kind of experience, to go through the same kind of thing? And was that a good thing, or should I not have been doing that? And that kind of made me take a pause and go, I'm not going up there anymore. And that's pretty much when I ceased going at any kind of interval, even in passing, to just go up and sit for 2 minutes. That didn't happen anymore. Lee and I used to go up to this spot, and you know, and it's not just UFOs there. There is hauntings in the area, all matter of weird shit. So you know, the human dynamic to that is that I think people see it. I think it freaks them out. I think they immediately associate it with you, and so that's the end of you. That's the end of a friendship or an acquaintance or whatever you want to call it. I think that person has to like Lee did not disappear, you know, when we had strange things occur together or experience strange things together. He didn't disappear because he was genuinely curious and interested. I think most people just get freaked out by it, and that's how they exit. And so ultimately, George Hansen's theory is right. You know, it's anti-structural, so it's not good for friendships, relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So you can take that for whatever it's worth.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting that you bring up that story, because I actually thought you were going to start talking about another one, which would have tied together what you're talking about, you know, the government. We don't know what the military weapons are versus what's an actual other UFO.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because this is something that you brought up the other night, and I wasn't sure if we'd actually talked about this on the show before.
I'm not sure either, to be honest with you.
I don't think we did, but if you want to talk about it, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I don't
give away your story, so.
No, I mean, I may have talked about this on other shows, or I may have brought it up, I'm not sure, but there was a whole period where, I mean, if you don't know about this area where my wife and I had this experience pretty early on in me looking into this stuff, I'm sure it's in an earlier show. It's probably one of our earlier, like way earlier, like in our archives, Jeff and Jer Solo or something like that. It's probably described in there, but this particular area where a major thing had happened involving me and my wife seeing a craft, and then me being not present, and her being in my vehicle with something and that clearly wasn't human, which she doesn't even really entertain talking about anymore in any great length. She used to describe it a lot when we would go to like support group meetings or talk to a researcher or something like that, but it genuinely upsets her. But that area for a while became, at the same time that I was very afraid to go into that area, there was almost a curiosity that just wouldn't go away. And so there were times after that that we kind of swallowed it and went up there and looked around, and we would see orange lights that would lift up out of the trees, not particularly close, but this is the same area where we saw the manta ray, the red, spotted red, you know, disc, edged lit. This is where this general area where everything that I've seen to have seen over the years that has been very in your face, this is the area I'm talking about. And there was a couple of times where we were in that area and had seen the lights. Could you define them as craft? Not necessarily, but a phenomena of some sort. I will say that was definitely not normal. But not long after our major event where we saw this disc there, we were in that area and saw a helicopter. Now, I don't know that I've ever mentioned this recently, but since we've picked up a lot of new listeners, if anybody knows what I'm going to describe here as far as this helicopter, I want you to write us at paratopiapodcast@gmail.com and let me know if you know anything about this. If any part of this sounds familiar to you, I'm dying to know what this is. There was a helicopter, clearly a Bell helicopter, and it was in, I would say, well, it was inside, I'd say, the general area where the disc was that we saw at a very close range, too close. It was flying right in that general area, and it had, now, everybody's got a digital alarm clock or probably has owned one at some point, and everyone knows what a a digital O or zero looks like. It's a top and bottom bar, and then the sides of the O are two bars. So you've got like this digital character. On the bottom of this helicopter was lights, and they were exactly in the configuration of a digital zero that encompassed the entire underside of this helicopter. And it was very vibrant, neonish looking blue. And we saw this thing, and it was literally hovering in the same general area as where we had had this UFO sighting. Needless to say, the UFO sighting has nothing to do with the helicopter. It definitely was not a helicopter. But we left the area because it wasn't leaving. And so when we turned around and started going down to a major road where there is shops and a grocery store and a drugstore, it more or less broke off its following of us. And it did follow us down a road directly behind us. I saw it. We saw this twice up there, at least, if not more, and never did find out what it was doing. It didn't follow us every time, but we saw it in the area at different times. The one night it did follow us. I believe it. I don't know how long it was after that, but it was. This is all in the same general. Let's just say within a 2 or 3 week period. I was going to work, and I pass this spot where we had this monumental UFO sighting and experience, and literally feet from where the manta ray later on was seen, all of that. And I'm passing this area, I'm passing this spot where I pulled over that night. And there are, and this is quite early in the morning, I'm going to work, and beside the road, almost exactly, back a little bit from where we had stopped that night, but is two black or dark sedans. And standing there beside the road are older men, mid, late 60s, early 70s, all of them with gray hair. They all had gray hair. And how many? I'm going to say eight, but I don't actually remember. There was more than a few, all standing there wearing business suits. And they are pointing in the direction of where we see this stuff. And I just keep going. And I mean, anybody would say, well, why didn't you pull over and ask what they were doing? And well, I've got no business asking anybody what they're doing there. It's not my land. I don't live there. I don't, you know, anything. And the other half was, why? I'm not going to stop and ask these people what they're doing, because what if they are looking at what this UFO thing was? It all just seemed to be way too coincidental, because you never, ever, ever see anyone stop beside that road there. Not ever. The most you will see is a CMP telephone truck stopping that's working on the lines. Past that, you're not seeing anyone stop along that road. And this was early. The mist was still out in the fields, and they are pointing. Now, I went to a MUFON meeting sometime later, and I had mentioned this helicopter to a lot of different people, and no one had a clue what it meant. And there was a man at the MUFON meeting who I think everyone pretty much knew, because I think he had told people that he was with a branch of the Air Force that dealt in heavy science and all of that, and this is, by the way, the same guy who had shown me video of a very weird craft that apparently is ours. And so he had a little bit of faith that he was who he said he was. And I mentioned this to him in the meeting place, but he seemed to want to wait until we got outside. And as I got outside, I lost track of where he was. And so Lisa and I just got in the car. And before we could pull away, there he was beside the car, and I got out, and I said, what's up? And he said, hey, you were talking about that helicopter. And he said, your shirt was blue. I was like, oh, yeah, definitely blue. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I think. I think that if there's been UFO activity around there and anything has gotten near the ground, that what they're looking for is artifacts, that light will illuminate whatever effect that something unknown would have on the ground. it would leave a footprint of some sort that this light would illuminate. And so they would be able to see that. He said there is a similar light, not in the configuration that you talk about, but there is a special light that they use to search for marijuana that will illuminate the plant. And so, you know, I'll offer that as maybe another explanation. But you said blue, and he said he was almost positive that the marijuana spotting light was a different color than what I saw and not in the configuration that I saw. He said, I'm thinking this is a foreign materials light, that's what it's meant to pick up. And so I don't know what to make of any of that. I don't know how valid any of that is. But if anybody knows what that kind of a lighting outfit is on a helicopter, I'd be really interested to know what that means or what it is. I only know what I was told, and I'm not sure I buy it. I mean, we were a little panicked when it started following us, when it was clear that it was following us. But once we got to kind of where it was a little bit more populated, I'd have to ask my wife if she remembers, but I'm almost positive that at a certain point it turned off the blue illuminators on the bottom and just became a helicopter and flew by us and went on its merry way. But we were a little panicked. I mean, it's weird when you know that they know you're looking at something and they're there and now they're going to follow you. I don't say I felt threatened, because what was it going to do? Land in front of the car? That would have been a little obvious. But I mean, that's essentially it. I mean, the guy standing beside the road, the helicopter, it just seems like whatever was going on there, and if that was something that I triggered by going there and having that experience, and this was the result of, yes, it was seen by someone else, and that someone else knows what this is or is more aware of it, or this is some kind of group that studies this in some faction of the government or private, I don't know. It just makes you wonder. I mean, a little too much to ascribe to coincidence. I mean, that just seems almost like an X-Files episode.
Well, I like the fact that they're all elderly men too, because
yeah.
Not sharing those need to know secrets with the younger generation.
Right. I mean, you guys know from everything that I've said that you know, I don't have any photographs of this, but I mean, tell you, anybody that wants to put me on a lie detector test or a voice stress or whatever, I don't care. I'm telling you, on a stack of Bibles, those men were there. That helicopter was there. My wife and I both saw it on a couple of different occasions. And all of this in an area where it seemed to be rife with UFO activity at the time. I would love to do kind of a dig in and look into that area more and see what more was going on. I know that not far from there, back in the 50s, there was some kind of crash of something that the military recovered and wouldn't let anybody see. And so I thought that was a little weird. And Lee and I went up there not long after my experience there with my wife. We went up there with a pretty high level at the time UFO researcher. And Lee asked him, do you get a lot of sightings around here? Because it certainly seems like the set and setting for something like this. And he says, no, you don't get a lot of UFO reports per se, but there's a lot of abduction experiences in this area. So I was like, wow, okay. Like to know more about that. If in fact that was true. I don't know. To me, it would be an interesting place to poke around in, but again, it's how involved do I want to be? How involved do I want to get up there? Because, in my opinion, what went on up there was noticed, and I don't think I would want to put my nose where it doesn't belong, and so I haven't really done anything with it. And like I said, aside from this show, I'm really not that much involved anymore with that kind of work, with that kind of digging in and going door to door and asking about stuff and what stories could you tell me. But I guess at some point I should do that, just to poke around and see. I mean, who knows? You could find – I told Jeremy last night on the phone, I honestly believe were I a different kind of guy and just viewed this very differently, I would have been – maybe another type of person would have taken throngs of people up there to go look and to skywatch and all of that. And I said, if that kind of thing had happened, I do believe that this area would have turned into a Pine Bush, New York, a Gulf Breeze, you know, possibly even, you know, a Ted Rowe Southwest, you know, place, that kind of place. If for no other reason than people were showing up to see this this phenomena. This place seemed to demand, and it may not have been this place, this may be how the whole thing operates, but it seemed to demand a certain amount of commitment to go up there on a nightly basis in an active pursuit of seeing something. And that really had to be your intention to go up there, is to see something. I want to know. I want to see. And you may get a little bit one night and then go the next night and it might be nothing. And then the third night, it'll be closer. And the fourth night, it'll be ridiculous. And then the fifth night, you get more than you asked for. I mean, that's just a, you know, that's very general. But I wonder if something like that doesn't work in that fashion. But yeah, old men beside the road. So figure that one out. So let me ask you, where you and your mom saw this craft, was that someplace that you was, that was not exactly in your area where you lived or where you traveled often? Is that correct?
It is where we traveled often, because we would often go. I mean, it was on the way to our grandparents.
Okay.
Her parents' place, and we went there a lot.
I mean, at any point, did you, in any of the times that you've been out and about, I mean, you mentioned something on a previous show about being out with friends and seeing a blue light and other people seeing this blue light that was almost following you guys. At any point, did you ever have anything that kind of smacked of, I don't know, conspiracy or like somebody knew this, somebody was watching and now was taking action to kind of ward you off or make you look or make you question what was really going on? Anything that sounds similar about what I just talked about?
No.
Hmm.
I got none of that.
I mean, what about people in the area of where
you were working on cases and stuff too? So that's,
yeah, I was, yeah. But I mean, in the area where you had that sighting, have you ever thought to talk to any people who live in that general vicinity and ask them, you know, is this something you've seen over the years or not? Or have you looked up on the net? You know, is there an abundance of sightings in that area or anything like that?
Well, where I saw the blue light, there weren't. Now there are housing developments, but before there wasn't anything. It was a cemetery and behind that a field, and it's out in the middle of the sticks. They've built it up recently, but there was nothing out there. And that was a two-parter, so that was part one, and part two was pulling into, I guess, a year later, 2 years later, whatever it was.
Right.
Pulling into a friend's driveway who lived out in the sticks in the complete opposite direction across town, and seeing that. And, you know, now he had never seen that, and he lives there. I don't think it ever dawned on me to ask the neighbors if they've ever seen anything like that.
Right.
I mean, but then again, at that point, I mean, I thought it was all about me anyway. So it was like I wouldn't have thought to ask, because it was all about me. I mean, you know, people seeing this in the car with me.
Right.
That was the first time they had seen anything.
Oh, okay. Do you still stay in touch with those people at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of them is Travis.
Okay.
Who lives near you now.
Right.
And the other one is my friend Adam, who I haven't. You know, he moved out to LA, but we're still in loose contact via Facebook.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's weird because, you know, when I sit in the back and after our conversation last night, when I was brushing my teeth, I was thinking about it and I was like, you know, really just about everything truly ridiculous that I have seen, in that area has happened within a quarter mile circle. All in that same type of area. Ghost, I mentioned to you last night, I don't think I've ever mentioned it on since we've been doing the show, but I used to hunt in the area. I used to deer hunt with a friend of mine. I don't hunt anymore, but and he used to like to go out at a ridiculous hour. I mean, like 3 a.m., he'd want to be out in the tree stand. And like you, like your place, there is a cemetery there. My grandparents are buried in there. Literally up the street from where we saw the disc and the men in the sedans and the helicopter and all of that. It's only right down the street and over a little rise, and there's the cemetery. And we used to hunt kind of adjacent to that. We'd park in the cemetery lot on top of the hill and walk down into the woods. And he and I were watching deer graze in very, very, very early morning light. And I remember his name was Ken. And we're sitting there next to each other, squatted down in the bushes. And between us on the ground, all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, he leans over me. He goes, "What the fuck is that?" And I said, "What's what?" He's like, "That right there." And he points with his finger, like kind of his hand up near his chest. He's right there. And I look down, and here is this thing on the ground between us that, for all descriptive efforts, looks like a star on the ground. And it's black between us, and I'm like, "It's something on the ground, dude." And I take my hand and I scrape away dirt on top of, you know, the ground in it, and it's not moving. It's like my hand's going over top of it, and I'm scraping dirt away, but I'm not touching anything. And there it is, and we're looking at it and looking at it. And what is this? And he's hitting it with his boot and scraping it with his heel, and it's not moving. It's not on the ground. It's there, but it's not there. And as morning came, it faded away. I mean, we looked there down every so often, and as it got brighter, it got dimmer. It never moved. It never got bigger. Just looked like a star in the sky. Take your camera and take a picture of a star in the sky and now put it on top of dirt on the ground. And that's exactly what it looked like. I mean, that's just fucking weird. What is that? And this is all in the same general vicinity, the same part of the country. So,
well, I wouldn't have made the leap to all of this phenomena, you know? It wouldn't have dawned on me. I mean, I remember reading about the Bridgewater Triangle and Bigfoot being seen and all that in some, like, little crappy, dingy newspaper somewhere.
Yeah.
Being shocked. I guess this is something that people knew, not me, but but other people knew about it.
Right.
And I remember looking for Bigfoot, you know, when it, like, be going down by the Rainham Dog Track, Paul.
Yeah.
That's one of the places where a cop allegedly saw it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I had never put together all of this sort of paranormal stuff.
Okay.
Although I did, curiously enough, when I wrote my first book, yes.
Your first book, yeah.
Back in, excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you. Back in high school, I did feature the Bridgewater Triangle as the centerpiece for where these aliens are doing sort of experimental work on people and creating creatures and things like that. So in my fiction, yeah. I made the leap, I made the connection, but it never translated into reality for me, and it never dawned on me to see the phenomena that way.
Mm.
Even though I had read, you know, I'm sure I'd read the Bigfoot connection or whatever in UFO Universe.
Yeah.
The old Timothy Green Beckley publication.
Right.
But it still seemed just too outlandish to me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it is, because the connection that they try to make in those types of publications is that E.T. and Bigfoot are working together, or, you know, Bigfoot is an E.T. or something like that, you know, and it's like, no, that's not, I don't think that's correct.
Right.
I'm going to George Hansen on this one.
Yeah. Right. I don't know. It's just, I mean, there's just all sorts of phenomena within, you know, this very small area. And you go, I mean, you go down to my work, which is probably a half a mile up the road or less, probably less, and there's nothing. I mean, there's just nothing of that magnitude. I mean, there's been weird shit in the shop that I've seen, but nothing that is like you could take someone to see this. I mean, it's all, you know, at the shop it's been, I hate to say, kind of in a subjective way, but even that, I mean, not a ton of stuff. Even going a mile or two further up the road where it does get extremely rural again, again, there's nothing there. I mean, you just don't see things there. You see things in this one tight little area. And that includes ghosts, by the way. I mean, there's a place there that is ridiculously haunted. And I've been told stories and I've seen things there myself that are ridiculous. I mean, just ridiculous. And so I wonder what it is. Is it the area? I mean, what is there of interest there? What is it about that place? So I don't know. I mean, all these ineffable questions that I just don't get, and I still don't get, but...
Or is it the Jacques Vallée thing of throw a dart at a map, form a triangle, and suddenly you've got a triangle?
Right. I mean, right.
It may just be prevalent everywhere.
It may be. It may be. I don't know. So anyway, I mean, again, just to repeat it, if you guys, if anybody out there has heard anything about or knows anything about the helicopter that I described, email us at paratopiapodcast.com. And Jeremy, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a little like human beef jerky.
Wait. Paratopiapodcast@gmail.com.
Did I say something else?
You just said .com.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But they know.
They should know.
They know now.
I'm really hot.
Yes, beef jerky.
It's hot.
It's very hot here as well. Let's go get some sweet, sweet relief in front of air conditioners.
Yes, that would be so good right now.
All right, Paratopia, I hope you enjoyed our little show.
Yeah.
And we will see you next week.
Good night.
Sweet dreams. I can't even say sweet dreams. That's how parched I am.
That's because you need water. I'm telling you, I'm shriveling.